Hello, this is Tom Uren of Seriously Risky Business, and hello, Grak, how are you today?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
I'm excellent. First of all, I'd like to thank the Hewlett Foundation's Cyber Initiative for supporting this podcast. I'd also like to thank this week's sponsor, Material Security, the company that provides visibility, defense in depth, and security infrastructure for Office 365 and Google Workspace. So one of the things you mentioned to me today, Grak, is that Merck, the pharmaceutical company, won a court case or won an appeal. And so the backstory is that, was it 2017?
Yes, it was 2017.
The Russians launched an attack on Ukraine. They compromised a server that sent out tax software. So this was a destructive supply chain attack. It was called DotPetya. One of the companies that was badly affected was Merck, and they had insurance. And so this case has been in the courts, well, since then. The actual NotPetya, just in case anyone doesn't remember, was a wiper type worm. So it would spread internally within companies. And so the way some big global companies were affected is they had a outpost or a business unit in Ukraine. It needed to do tax in Ukraine. The malware appeared within that corporate outpost and spread globally. So that was probably a mistake. It seems from my point of view that that's not the best sort of targeting. But anyway, you were saying that you think that's the right outcome, but maybe not for the right reasons.
Right. So the finding was that NotPetya was not war.
Yeah. So what we're going to talk about is whether insurance can or will work for improving cybersecurity. And there's two standard clauses that are often present. One is we'll insure you, but not if it's an act of war, whatever that means, which I'm sure you'll go into. And the other one is an act of God.
Right. And so, I don't know, maybe that's the next angle that they're going to try and argue. NotPetya is an act of God. Here's the thing. I think that NotPetya was not an act of war, because I think cyber attacks are not actually attacks. In terms of like Geneva Convention type stuff, they don't really make sense as attacks. They make sense as covert action, espionage, that sort of thing. And thinking about them as physical attacks, it's maybe a useful shortcut, but it's not a good analogy in reality.
Right. Now, I'm just thinking that if on the day of invasion, the real invasion of Ukraine, the Russians had disrupted Viasat and also launched NotPetya on the same day, surely then it's an act of war, right?
Right.
It would be an integrated operation. It makes me think that,
yes,
what were the Russians doing back in 2017? They've wasted could well have been a really targeted supply chain attack that would have done some serious damage.
Yeah, so apparently, I talked to some of the people who did the forensics on that server, and there were multiple groups that had access. there were probably people who were just really pissed off at the Russians for burning their great supply chain attack that they were using to hit like all of the Ukraine companies for months, and then out of nowhere, you know, here comes a GRU to screw it up for everyone.
Who were these actors? Were they like different Russian groups or criminals or?
That was my understanding, that the server was so open that like anyone who wanted a shell had a shell.
Right.
But okay, so the finding that the judge had was that it wasn't war, and his reasoning was based on there was no death, you know, no violence against people.
Right.
So it's not an act of war because it's not harming anyone.
Right, right. So you transplant it, and it is because there's actual shooting going on at the same time.
Right. So that was one of his reasons. And then the other one was that it impacted Russia as well. So if it was an act of war, it was indiscriminate, and therefore it couldn't have been a targeted attack. It couldn't have been launched as an attack, as an act of war, because it harmed Russia too. Therefore, it's not an act of war. And as we know, the majority of weapons are very discriminate in who they harm during wartime. Like, shells don't explode if they land next to your own side. Bullets are harmless. Mines stop working.
The difference is kind of blast radius, right?
Yes. So, like, the thing is, NotPetya was actually, it was tightly targeted if it wasn't autonomous.
Yep.
They were distributed via Ukraine tax software, right? Like, they would hit companies that operate in Ukraine. It's targeted at the economic center of Ukraine. It makes complete sense until you add that self-propagation element.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I think the Russians were probably as surprised as the rest of us at just sort of how many dark network connections there existed.
Yeah, there's a great Andy Greenberg write-up on Wired of NotPetya, and it looks particularly at Maersk, which is a Danish shipping company, and that had a very flat network, and it wiped the whole network except for one domain controller that was offline. Because there'd been a power failure in, I think, Nigeria.
Yeah. So. They had, you know, sysadmins in first class on private jets flying down to try and rescue that one thing before.
Yeah,
and
it seems like, as an aside, that the Russians actually learned from that, because you look at Viasat and relatively targeted.
Yeah, I think if we want to talk about those, you know, accidental propagation, I think WannaCry, which was the same year and only, I think, 6 months earlier.
Yep.
It was another sort of accidental spread of a piece of software that caused outsized harm to what it was intended. It was supposed to propagate across one network and, you know, make it so that they didn't have to do manual installation of their ransomware when they hit a corporate network. And instead, it took out the NHS.
Right. But I guess in terms of insurance, what I think they really want is some get-out-of-jail-free card for kind of correlated risk. And so in a war, like if it comes to physical stuff in a war,
right,
the idea is so much can get destroyed in the same place. I don't want to be responsible for insuring that because I can't do anything about it. Like,
right.
And that seems kind of fair enough.
Right. Well, it makes sense, you know, because if you've got your actuary tables of like, is this factory going to get destroyed? And you could look at it and say, like, in the normal course of events, a fire breaks out in this percentage of factories per year, blah, blah, blah. We can figure out what the odds are there. Or there hasn't been an earthquake and it's not in a fault line, so we know it's not going to, like, that's not going to be an issue for us. You can do all these things and you can figure out, like, what are the odds. But as soon as it goes to war, the odds start edging up towards 100%.
Yeah, they change.
Right.
And who knows how they change.
Right, and they change in arbitrary ways on arbitrary days. It's just impossible. And yeah, you don't want to be on the hook for, like, every bomb that gets thrown randomly. So, yeah, like, get out of jail free for war makes sense, but I think using it in cyber is difficult. But I think one of the other things is they probably should have gone for act of God, right? Because what are the odds that just sort of out of nowhere, this thing shows up and, like, wipes billions of computers across the world?
Well, I think the problem with that is that over time we've come to realize that it wasn't God, it was just the GRU. And act of God
seems
not
the Messiah, he's the Russian military intelligence director.
Just a very naughty Russian intelligence person. And so act of God seems to make sense for natural disasters where you can't apportion blame to some faceless, nameless bureaucrat. But what I thought would be good is pivot to the why people believe that insurance will be good for cybersecurity, right?
Right. So here we've got this issue of going to court and arguing if a cyber incident is actually an act of war so you can get out of jail free. And I think, you know, we've discussed that a little bit and it's kind of amusing, but in a way it highlights sort of one of the issues that comes up. Like, I remember when cyber insurance was starting to be a thing, a lot of people had an idea that cyber insurance was going to save us. Like, he was finally the thing that was going to get everyone secure. You'd have your cyber insurance provider, they would show up and they would say, you know, you have to have policies that require patching in reasonable time, and you have to have modern equipment, and you have to, you know, follow these basic sort of things, and that would save us. Like, that was the idea.
Yeah, yeah. So the rationale is that paying for insurance would give companies an economic incentive to improve the security. And the sort mm-hmm. of mechanism would be insurers would give discounts or write policies when people did certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, they would learn what those certain things should be based on their visibility into insurance claims.
Right.
Right. So there was this kind of cycle where you've got a pool of companies you insure, some get breached, you figure out what went wrong, you say to everyone, if we're going to insure you, you need to do these things, yada, yada. And that kind of intellectually makes sense.
Right. I mean, it works for banks, right? Like, if you're a bank and you want to have insurance to operate, you have to have, you know, like a silent alarm and a dye pack and, you know, CCTV and these things, because otherwise no one's going to insure you, because you have to take these minimum security efforts to be secure. So why doesn't that translate into cyber? Why don't we have cyber CCTV and cyber dye packs and cyber silent alarms?
So you think that cyber insurance, at least that mechanism, hasn't improved cybersecurity?
Yeah. So I think part of the problem is a lot of the stuff gets done as lip service.
Right.
Right. So you'll have a policy that says, before you can put out a web app, it has to be pen tested.
Right.
Like, it has to go through a red team assessment. And so you call up your red team assessment provider. You say, we've got another one of those things that you need to do by Friday. We've got the money allocated. The company comes in, they do their thing, they give you the report. You take the report, you clip it to, you know, have you done a pen test? Yes, we have. Here's the report. Next.
And then you shred it so no one can ever find what the findings were in case you ever get breached. So that's a no, right?
Yeah, I don't think helped. And I think some of the best practices don't help just because things advance in a way that what sort of made sense 2 years ago when you wrote it down maybe is no longer sensible.
Yeah.
Particularly things like when people all got VPNs and deployed VPNs. That made sense as a thing to do. But then if you just kept the same VPN appliance in place from 2016 until 2020 when you suddenly needed to use it, and so, you know, you go and you turn it on again and find out that it's been end of life and it's so many patch levels behind, but you kind of need it, so you just keep using it, and then you get breached because of it. And it just, like, it seems to me that the idea that you could write up a list of, if you do these specific concrete steps, then you will be secure, that makes sense maybe at a frozen point in time. But then as it evolves, you know, you have to evolve with it. I think that that's difficult for insurance to do.
Yeah, yeah. If the landscape's always changing. So I spoke to a reinsurer.
Uh-huh.
This was some time ago. He was great. I asked him about cyber insurance.
Uh-huh.
His view was that it was problematic. And one significant difference is that, unlike a lot of other insurance, there's an attacker involved, an adversary who's a thinking adversary.
Uh-huh.
So unlike, say, natural disaster, floods, hurricanes, I guess maybe like bank robbery insurance. Yeah.
I think it's like fire insurance where you only deal with arsonists.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, like, you can look at and say statistically, your fires only happen this often in this sort of warehouse.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's just someone doing arson, then your statistics don't matter.
Yeah. So he was also concerned about correlated risk. And I guess that's that kind of automated worm affecting many things risk. But his point also was that there's not a lot of long-term data, but also that the conditions are always changing. So even if you have long-term data, maybe that doesn't tell you anything anyway. But his view was that they couldn't afford not to be involved because the shift was towards intangible assets. So from a big picture business point of view, they had to get in to the industry.
Right.
Now, another person I spoke to who's involved in cyber insurance said that the way that it worked for them is that rather than telling companies what to do, they would do the research on, I guess, a portfolio of different products that they recommended that their companies used.
Right.
And certainly when he spoke to us, it seemed like also a reasonable thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We vouch for these things, attest that they're useful.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of sort of makes sense. He believed that it worked. I've got no data.
Right. I bet he doesn't either. Yeah. Oh, maybe he does. Yeah.
It's hard to know, right? Like companies with cyber insurance are breached all the time. And in fact, there's there's actually the opposite, where ransomware crews will look for companies with insurance.
Right, because they know that there's a pool of money that will pay them out. You know, for a ransomware crew, it makes a lot more sense. Like, first of all, there's going to be an insurance requirement that your ransomware incident is handled by a competent negotiator and experienced ransomware type person. And these guys probably have a relationship with the ransomware crews where they can say, okay, you're asking for $1 million. Hey, Dimitri, Ivan again, how are things going over there? How's the wife and kids? Good, good, good. Listen, we've got a bit of an issue. You've hit one of my clients, and can we do 250? Yeah, same place? Okay, great. See you tomorrow. Have a good one.
I definitely remember reading that in one of the ransomware gang leaks, that they had a maybe captive negotiator isn't the right word, but the negotiator was getting kickbacks.
See, I'm not accusing them of that. I don't think that there's a nefarious relationship going on.
I think not always. In this one case, there was.
Right. With the amount of money involved, that's certainly not out of the question. But I think it just makes sense. If you are like Dimitri, the ransomware negotiator, every single time you hit somewhere, you're starting from scratch with people who have to, like, are these guys serious?
Yep.
How far can I push them? Can I lie to them? How much can I dick them around? How long can I string them? Like, all of the stuff you have to deal with every single time. And it's got to be so exhausting. There you are. You're trying to extort some money from your criminal activities. And these people are just rude. They lie and they cheat. You're just trying to make a buck for crimes. And it's got to be so much easier to deal with the same person who knows the game.
Right, yeah.
And run through it quickly. So you can speed run your negotiation. You get to the point where you get paid out and everyone moves on. And so similarly for the insurance, you want to be dealing with someone who has a track record of getting these things resolved for less than the ransomware request. So it makes sense there. And then as a victim, you just want it to be over with. And so if the insurance says, hey, use these guys and we'll cover everything, and you'll be back up in like 3 days, everyone's happy. And I guess the only problem is what one might call a perverse incentive. Now, if you want, you could, hit someone that you don't know if they're going to pay out, and you're going to have to deal with them as these newbie negotiators. Or you could just find one of your old reliable, covered by insurance, has a bundle of money, has your known negotiators, and you hit those. And so they were, right? I don't know if they still are.
I think they would search for insurance policies when they compromised a network and see what was covered. And that was part of their prioritization process. I think for Conti, they would, which of these companies that we have access to, where's the most likely payoff?
Right, covered up to $5 million. Okay, let's hit those guys.
Yeah.
So one of the things that people thought was going to happen with cyber insurance is that there is going to be this incentive to have a lot more penetration tests and ongoing continuous evaluation of security. And thanks to ransomware, there is.
Yeah, so there's.
So there you go.
The whole cyber insurance industry is funded involuntary, unscoped pen tests.
It's the single biggest driver for security that we have. So
thanks a lot, Crack.
Thanks a lot, Tom.